Family Secrets is a production of iHeartRadio.
I'm Danny Shapiro, and this is part two of a special bonus episode of Family Secrets. I'm speaking with journalist and author Libby Copeland about DNA discoveries that unleash the long-held secrets that affect so many of our lives, and how, as a society, we can learn to grow, evolve, change, and understand one another. There's a pretty big leap of empathy that needs to be made for people who have never considered or had the experience themselves of that kind of disruption to their origin story, just thinking, what difference does it make? Or a favorite line that was delivered to me on an index card in, you know, during a Q&A was, what good is knowing? And I almost like laughed when I was like, I actually kept that index card and I have it pinned to my bulletin board in my office, because what good is knowing? It's everything. And, you know, in Family Secrets, in every episode, whether it ends up in the final episode or not, I always ask my guests, you know, whose like family secret we're unpacking, do you wish you hadn't found out? Do you wish you hadn't known? And not a single one in 30 guests thus far, no one has said, yes, I wish I didn't know. No one. In fact, one of my favorite responses was from my friend Sylvia Borstein, who is a mindfulness Buddhist meditation teacher in her 80s.
Yeah.
And she just, we were in person and she looked at me and she said, do I what? Do I wish I had? I mean, she couldn't even understand the question of like, how could you possibly wish that you didn't know? And that doesn't mean that it's not painful and hard, but the relief that, that people feel, because that hole in the heart that you're talking about, like, I think with people who have always known that they were adopted and who didn't have access to their birth parents or their origin story, the term in adoption literature is genealogical bewilderment. The sense of sort of walking around just not knowing. And so that's, I would say, probably what people describe as the hole in their hearts. But then there's the not knowing and the not knowing that you don't know, which is the case with so many people whose stories have been withheld from them. And that is a different kind of hole in the heart. That's like a hole in the heart that you don't know is a hole in your heart. You just, you just have this ache, but you don't, the ache doesn't have a name. It doesn't have a story attached to it. And so when it does, and this is not just, this isn't just my experience, it's the experience of everyone that I've talked to. There's just a feeling amid all the shock and pain and confusion and disorientation of palpable relief. Like, oh, this makes so much sense.
Yes. Yeah. And kind of like the people would talk to me about, there's a sense of excavating. So you make the discovery, and then in the days and weeks and months that follow, there's this process of unbidden excavation of the past where these memories arise and all of a sudden, you know, make sense. These memories, you know, of an interaction with your mom where she said something and then you haven't thought about it in 30 years and suddenly you're putting that statement that she made into a different context and it's like ping. And so there's this kind of emotional archaeology that people would talk about where they were reprocessing everything from once upon a time on forward. And they were reprocessing it with the knowledge that put everything into a different perspective. And there's a term that you used in one of your interviews, unthought known. And I don't know if that's exactly what this is, but it's like this sense of kind of sensing something, but maybe not even totally admitting it to yourself, if I have it right.
Yeah.
And so again, we're talking about commonalities, right? And how do these many, many different experiences among many different people of different ages and different demographics, how do they align themselves with one another? Because that's part of the amazing thing about this moment is the humanness, commonalities of the human experience. And one of the things over and over is that people would say to me, and I'm sure they've said to you, you know, I kind of always wondered about that, even if I never quite totally admitted it, or I always had questions, or now it all makes sense, right? And there may be for some people, I did interview people who said they had never an inkling at all, but enough of them who did that it may be that there's a kind of a nascent knowledge, like you said, mm-hmm. you know, a feeling of outsiderness, or maybe little things that you pick up on that add together into this kind of, I don't know, diaphanous, gauzy sense of nagging question. Mm-hmm. And then the DNA test comes along and it's like, there's the question solidified right there and there's an answer.
Absolutely. No, that's beautifully put. And the unsought known, which is a psychoanalytic term, you know, really refers to that which we know, like we know it in our bones. We know it, you know, we know it like when we talk about a sixth sense, but we it's too dangerous to articulate to ourselves. So we never actually consciously think it. It's more like, you know, why would anyone really ever entertain the thought that, oh, maybe this isn't my biological parent? It's just, it's there's so much confirmation bias and so much need to, I mean, I adored my father and felt so incredibly connected to him and still do, even though he's been gone for more than half my life. But to ever think the thought, maybe he's not my biological father, would have been impossible for me. And,
right.
And yet there is a way in which I knew, you know, I never thought it. But when I went back and read my early work as a writer, it's in there. It's like a trail of breadcrumbs. Mm. It's like the unconscious made conscious, or the unconscious, like on the page, there it is. So I actually have something that even amounts to a kind of proof of the unthought known in my own life. But if someone had put, you know, given me a polygraph or whatever and said, you know, do you think that your father isn't your biological father? I'd be like, what are you talking about? What could possibly give you that idea?
I think that's why the fact that the various companies put up a warning saying you may discover unexpected relatives, I think that's why those warnings don't take root. I mean, you just sort of explained it so wonderfully. It kind of all clicked into place in my brain. Of course, as you're saying, even if you're someone who on some less than conscious level could have questioned it, maybe questioned it, you couldn't on a conscious level.
No, and so, exactly.
And so a warning is not, it's as good as a puff of smoke.
We'll be back in a moment with more Family Secrets.
You know, there's also this part of it that has to do with sort of basic human instincts or kind of like a primal way of reacting to things, which is that another thing that I noticed in the, you know, the other side of this, not the seekers, but the people who were either the secret keepers or the donors, you know, or mm-hmm. The sort of world around the secret keepers and the donors, is that, or not donors. I mean, it could be the same thing if somebody had an affair, that when someone approaches a family that, or a person who believes that they know the outer perimeter of their family, they, you know, they have three kids, or, you know, they know their story, they know the story of their family, and suddenly there's a person, an interloper, an outsider, sending an email or sending a letter or making a phone call and saying, I just don't really understand this, but it seems we're related. It seems that you might be my half-sibling, or you might mm-hmm. be my biological parent. I don't understand. The first reaction almost across the board is to feel threatened. What do you want from me?
Yeah.
It often goes to somehow the financial, you know, are you looking for something? You want my, even people who like don't have two nickels to rub together are like, you want my money? You know, is that why you're contacting me? And it's a primitive, I think, like, it probably has a kind of biological root in we know or we think we know who our kin is. And our kin are usually people who are our kin biologically and who we know, who we've raised or who we've, you know, existed with in a family dynamic. And then it upends the idea of what that is.
Yeah, it upends things that people consider sacred because it's, you know, it's disruptive to your narrative of your father if, say, he conceived a child while he was married to your mother. Or even before, it would seem to conflict, for some people, it would seem to conflict with his loyalty to you. Now, if you'd grown up with four siblings instead of three, you wouldn't question his loyalty to you. But to have three siblings and suddenly there's a fourth, you know, in my book, I write about, you know, people's reactions. There's the father who deletes his kit because he doesn't want a relationship with his daughter. There's the father who sends a cease and desist letter to his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Very often women doing the seeking, I found.
Mm.
You know, there's a case of a woman who her parents are no longer alive, but she reaches out to her siblings on both sides. She's adopted and she finds the identity of her genetic parents, her late parents, and she reaches out to her siblings on both sides. And one side basically says, listen, our dad was not a great guy. And this is like just really painful and upsetting. You know, having a relationship with you reminds us of him and we don't have great memories of him. So no, thank you.
Mm.
And on the other side, her mother's children, they're basically like, wait a minute. You know, you're telling us that our mother, before we were born, had a baby, never told us about it, gave that baby up at 4 days old by putting that baby in a basket on a pastor's doorstep? No. Because, you know, for us to incorporate this story into our memories of our late mother is to invite all sorts of questions about her personality, her character, her values, the limits of her maternal love. No, thank you. And in that instance, you know, denial can be a really powerful thing. And the sisters basically said, like, 23andMe is wrong.
Mm.
Oh, sure, it says we're half siblings on this relative chart, but, you know, they must have made a mistake.
Mm.
And no amount of fact-finding or evidence-bearing is going to alter their perception because it's not a question of fact. It's a question of emotion and honestly, sacred truths, like narratives, like, you know, you have an understanding of your family, you have an understanding of who your mom was. And, you know, it's an interesting, you know, writing The Lost Family, I told a lot of stories of the seekers. These are the people who are testing. These are the people who are finding out about themselves. They have a lot of agency. They have a lot of autonomy. It's painful, but they're glad to know.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side are the stories of people who are not talking because these are secrets. So these are not stories that they're telling. So, you know, if I'm writing about a woman and she's reaching out to her father and he deletes his kit, I'm basically writing around the negative space of his response rather than interviewing him. And that's an interesting thing to think about, I think, as we go into this new world is, you know, what is it like for the people on the other side? And you know, what stories do they have to tell, if any? And is there a way, and honestly, I don't know the answer to this, but is there a way to make it easier for everyone to reconcile? Because I know, maybe that's not the right question to ask because maybe that doesn't include enough of the experiences of the people who are being sought and don't want to be found. But you know, there can be a lot of trauma and pain on the other side too. You know, if you were an unwed mother, sort of forced to give up your child, or who endured a act of coercion or rape. You know, these experiences of being found can be incredibly painful. And I mean, it's a question without an answer, but it was one of the things that I really thought was so moving and difficult to write about, was this idea that, you know, you take two people who are closely genetically related and they're at the very beginning of what could be an intimate relationship in their meeting for the first time, and their interests can seem to be in conflict at exactly the moment when they most need to not be in conflict. And it just doesn't always have a happy ending, unfortunately.
I wonder how it might be possible for the people who are sought, you know, who don't have agency in that sense. They didn't ask to be sought. They, in some cases, hadn't known that there was a secret, and in other cases have kept a secret all their lives. In other cases, haven't even thought of it as a secret, have just thought of it as something, like in the case of donors, something that they did when they were 22 years old and never thought about again.
Right.
And ascribe no importance to. And we're not hearing the voices of those people. Why? Because it's a secret. And so in the same way that nothing's been, until very recently, nothing has been studied about the implications psychologically and emotionally of donor conception, or, you know, sort of just secrecy when it comes to identity kept from children. You know, there haven't been long-term studies about any of that because no one was talking, because it was a secret. Now, that's starting to not be the case for a whole host of reasons, and people are talking and are making these discoveries by the, you know, thousands per week are making these discoveries just because of the sheer numbers of people who are still purchasing and taking, you know, home DNA tests. But the people on the other side of that, the families that these people, and I include myself in these people, you know, basically come crashing into, like, hi, you know, hi, it's me. I think you're my biological father. I know this is going to be shocking, but, you know, I'm always taken aback when people ask me, did you think long and hard before you reached out to your biological father? And the answer is, I didn't think at all. I was in survival mode. I was trying to put together the pieces of me and the puzzle of me, as you were saying before.
Yeah.
I was completely unmoored, and it really felt like a matter of survival for me. And I think that is true for many people who make this discovery and are shocked by it. But on the other side of that, there is often an elderly person, a person who has his own children, a person who gave up a child for adoption and it's always been painful, who maybe never told her own, you know, husband of many years or grown children. I mean, there's so many ways in which our narratives can become upended. And yet the question that I think is going to, you know, preoccupy bioethicists and maybe really needs to be asked more is, what can we do to make this, the fact of this connection, you know, the truth of this, something that we can all tolerate at least enough to be kind to each other. So in the case of the story you were telling from your book, the mother's family, her children, who say, that can't be the case. We can't square that with our memory of our mother. She never would have done that. They're actually dealing with the same level of traumatic discovery as the person in your book who's discovering who her birth parents really were. But they're not able to make that empathic leap to, this is another human being and she's suffering.
Right. It's my sacred truth in conflict with your sacred truth. So yours has to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the terrible thing for the seeker in that situation, whose name is Jackie, the woman in my book, is that, you know, and for many other people who are doing the seeking, is you to it's such an unfair thing for them to have to basically be the messenger of their own existence, right? Don't blame the messenger. That's the saying. If I come knocking on your door and I say, hey, my name is Libby and I exist and I'm your father's child, you know, I bear the brunt of all the emotions that you would bring to any messenger of such news if it were not welcome. And yet it is me. It is me, vulnerable me. I mean, in many ways, the person who's doing the seeking is twice vulnerable, because they're looking for connection with their genetic kin. And then they also have to be the one to bring the news. And the person bringing the news of something that could be disruptive to the person on the other side is possibly going to catch some flack for that. And then they feel very rejected. And, you know, the extent of the support for people in these positions is basically Facebook groups. And there's all these Facebook groups, and you see over and over, you know, people writing about, I reached out to my birth mother. She doesn't want anything to do with me. I reached out to my biological dad. He doesn't want anything to do with me. I reached out to my siblings, and they've rejected me and, you know, said this is a hoax or whatever. And, you know, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. The stories really run the gamut. There are some that are beautiful and you think, man, like that's a gorgeous story. That makes me cry. And there are some that are so sad that they make you cry for different reasons. It's a bit of a roulette wheel. You don't know what you're going to get, and you can't control the outcome. You can't control how this person on the other side, who's genetically very related to you, but is a stranger, how they're going to respond to the news that you're bringing them.
We'll be right back. I want to ask you one last question. I could talk to you for, we should have a 3-hour podcast about this, because it's just, you're saying such amazing things. But, you know, you touch in your book on regulation and the future and, you know, the question of, there's still so many structures that are in place that promote the possibility of keeping things a secret, even as the impossibility of it being kept a secret is upon us. I mean, I can't tell you how many people will say to me, you know, and you and I touched on this before, but will say to me, well, I'm not going to do one of those tests because I don't want anybody finding me. And, you know, I'm like, well, good luck with that. Or, you know, we are reaching a point where the web of data, genetic data connecting us, is going to be, you know, pretty much, you know, is already not dependent on whether somebody actually orders in one of these tests, right, and spits into the tube. But do you have any thoughts about sort of moving forward? What would be helpful aside from the idea that, you know, I think it's very, very interesting that the seekers and the sought both need their own kind of support and study and understanding.
Yeah, you know, I think for one thing, it's very clear that fertility banks can't promise anonymity to their sperm donors anymore. And I think that needs to be very upfront. It needs to be very clear that anonymous sperm donor is an oxymoron at this point.
Egg donors too.
Yeah, and you know, that should just be something that's made clear to someone as they're donating. You know, that's pretty much a ship that has sailed. You know, I do think there's a great need for bioethical and psychological research. I don't think there's sort of putting any cat in the bag, so to speak. Like, I don't think that there's, in my reporting and interviewing, I haven't heard anyone say, well, you know, here's how we could regulate DNA testing, or here's how we should. Now, maybe I'm just not in the conversations where that's being proposed, at least not for the reasons that we're talking about. In other words, nobody is talking about a method that would permit this industry to exist and also at the same time make it impossible to find unexpected genetic family. You wanted that outcome, which it's not clear to me, it's not clear to me that you would. I mean, given the number of people who say that, as painful as this experience has been, you know, they were glad to know. You know, it's not clear to me that there would be, you know, that's where you'd want to go with it. But if you could, you know, it's intrinsic to the technology itself that you get a list of relatives that we all share. You know, I share overlapping genetic segments with the people I'm related to. So there's no way to really take that out of your results. Right. So, you know, and even if you did, you know, you would still have ethnicity estimates, which, you know, if you are the child of a man of Scottish descent and you discover you are not at all Scottish, you know, that in itself is, can be a clue depending on how good a company's ethnicity estimates are. Mm-hmm. So the question of regulation, I mean, I do see a lot of conversations around regulation of DNA testing that pertain to issues like privacy and genetic discrimination. But I have yet to see a serious conversation that talks about how we treat the question of familial revelations. And I guess I think that's where this is eventually going, is that I feel like a lot of the bioethical conversations around genetic testing have centered on medical results, have centered on privacy, have centered on genetic discrimination. They have not really talked about how it impacts the family and the individual on a personal level when they discover that, for instance, that they are the product of a non-paternity event or a not parent-expected event, an NPE. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it has to go. Because I think the majority of people who have an experience of DNA testing, their experience is not getting it from their doctor. Their experience is not one of really interesting or surprising or upsetting or revelatory health-related results. You know, the vast majority of the way that people are experiencing DNA testing is through commercial tests. It's because they test to find out whether they need to transform their lederhosen into a kilt, as that ad goes. Mm-hmm. And then they find out something that is like, whew, mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. And really, there's almost, I think, a disconnect between, you know, the academia that looks at genetic testing in one way, and the real life American consumer experience of it, which is that if you're going to get a surprise, it is this kind of surprise that you're getting, not not that your data is being breached, or that your insurer is declining to insure you, but this, and this is the stuff of people's most intimate lives. This stuff matters so much. So I just think that we need to be having like a really serious national conversation around this, because there's only, you know, we've got between 30 and 35 million people in the database at this point, the databases of the major four companies. And now you're seeing them pivot towards offering other products, and that number is only going to go up.
Mm-hmm. And it's estimated that somewhere around 2% of people taking these tests do make a not paternity expected or non-parental event discovery. And that's, you do the math, that's a hell of a lot of people.
And then yes, for sure. And then if you factor in the discovery of a half sibling that you didn't know about,
right?
If you factor in late discovery adoptees, if you factor in the people whose genetic ancestries were hidden from them to protect them, you're talking about millions of people. And then if you look at the way a single secret refracts across a family, if I discover that I'm the product of an NPE, it impacts, say, there's three other people in my family that it impacts. It also impacts the family of the man I now discover I'm genetic related to. So that's another four people. Mm-hmm. So you've got eight people impacted by a single discovery. So you're talking millions of Americans, many of whom never even tested, impacted by this. It's a cultural transformation. It's an astonishing moment. I think we're going to be talking about this for decades to come.
I completely agree. And I just keep on having this image as you're speaking of people, these millions of people who are being impacted and affected, whether directly or the familial or the ripple effect, are like alone in their homes contending with
it.
There's no
formal support.
There's no formal support. And it's a huge seismic you know, psychological and emotional tsunami that's hitting people, and I know they don't know where to go because they come to me or they come to you. I mean, just like the volumes of mail or people coming to my events back when events were a thing, you know, are just huge. And this desire, tremendous desire to gather and to share and to be with other people who are having this experience, or to have people understand what the experience is, to not feel sort of that other rejected, alien feeling, the lonely boat metaphor, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, this will go a long way to making that lonely boat metaphor be something that doesn't feel that way, that feels, mm-hmm. You know, because what we I think generally as human beings want, and one of the things I've seen again and again from hosting this podcast, is that when we're able to really inhabit our truth and see it and speak it and share it and not feel shame about it and have that sense that there's this wide array of people who are also going through this thing, and there's help, there are people who know how to talk about it, there are therapists who know how to find the language for it and be of support, is going to make a huge difference moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we were all, the analogy that I just thought of as you were talking about is, you know, this coronavirus that we're going through and this kind of imposed self-isolation that we're all in. And if I were doing this on my own, for some reason, I would feel so much more profoundly alone. Mm-hmm. But I know that my friends are doing it, my parents are doing it, everyone I know is doing it, and lots of people I don't know. And I feel like a sense of solidarity because we're all alone together. And I think that's why you've seen these, you know, Facebook groups crop up with, you know, 120,000 members. And that's just one of them. And many of them have 60,000 or 20,000. And for every specific type of DNA revelation that you can make, there is a group out there. And it's because we need to know we're not alone, and we need to normalize this experience. We really need to normalize this experience so that nobody feels like this is their secret shame, that this is their just their messed up family, right? Or just their family that kept things from them. There should be a common language. There should be a common, the parallels of these experiences should be made clear for people so that we all know we all are starting from the same point. And if you've had this happen to you, there are millions of other people out there to whom this has happened. And we all have our family dysfunctions, and we can all sort of be together in that and share those experiences.
Mm, Libby, that's perfect. That is a sort of perfect, true, and hopeful message to end this conversation on. I've just absolutely loved talking to you about this, and you've thought so deeply about it. And yeah, just thank you. Thank you for your beautiful book.
Well, thank you so much. This is so helpful, so wonderful to talk to you.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.